Now, there were a couple of comments which I made yesterday, which I would like to draw some attention to, because they have been mentioned to me a number of times. Firstly, there were a number of people who came to me and said, look, I never realised that you could use the Psalms for so many things, and you outlined very, very quickly yesterday a number of things that when you're anxious or leaving home or upset and so forth that you could use the Psalms for. And I've been racking my brains trying to think how I would answer that question. Now, I've got the answer this morning for you. What I suggest you do is you go along to the local motel, and you select there one of the Gideon Bibles that are placed there, or you swipe a loan of your kid's New Testament that comes home from school from the Gideons, and you'll find in the front of that some helpful comments. You'll find that in the front of that is outlined some of the, of course, or some of the Psalms and what they can be used for, as I outlined to you yesterday. It doesn't deal with them all, but it's a good introduction and it will give you quite a number to use. The second point that I want to comment on is I spoke on translations, and there were a number of people that had never heard so much on translations in all their lives. I suggest to you that you come and have a little more think about these translations and how we got them, and I was asked to just run through it again. You recall that I said that the Lord used the Old Testament translation in Hebrew, and thus his comments from out of Psalm 22, Eli, Eli, which is a straight Hebrew translation, and he was using the Hebrew translation in what he said. The disciples, in fact, used the Old Testament, and of course, they used an Aramaic or a colloquial Hebrew translation. And thus you get the situation in Mark, where Mark was saying, Eloi, Eloi. And so they were using the Aramaic, the colloquial translation, if you like. But from Hebrew to Greek, it went originally by the Septuagint. The Septuagint 70 was the translation by the 70 elders, and you recall they translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek. Now that Greek translation was used and translated into Latin, and so we had the Old Testament in Latin. And so the Hebrew went to Greek and the Greek went to Latin, and it was St. Jerome who took that Latin translation and revised it and came up with a revised Latin translation. He used originally the Septuagint's translation to get into his particular translation, but the major translation work that he did came from the original Hebrew and went straight into Latin. That was the second translation that he did, and you recall, if you study that it was 380 AD that St. Jerome did that translation. It was called the Vulgate, and it was known as the Great Bible. That was in particular the one that was changed to the back of the church, and the one that I referred to that you had to be a scholar to be able to read it because it was written in Latin. That was St. Jerome's original Vulgate or the Great Bible. But of course, you will find that the Hebrew and the Greek and the Latin were drawn together in the authorised version of the Scriptures and presented to us in English. Now, there were other translations available, but that was the one that was authorised by the King at the time. And so, just by way of rundown, you should note that the Old Testament was quoted Hebrew to English by the Lord. In the New Testament, quite often you will find that they are quoting the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So you have the Old Testament translated to Greek, and the early church apostles were quoting that Greek translation, and that was then translated into English. Thus you will see that there is quite often a slight variation between what appears in the English version of the Bible in the Old Testament and what appears in the New Testament between that and the direct translation or the direct quote. Because one is going from the Hebrew to the English and the other is going from the Hebrew to the Greek to the English. And there is a slight variation in the translation that transpires in that actual quote. So you can see some difference. Now let's get back to the Psalms, having tidied up the questions around the place. Any more questions? Happy to deal with. Lunch or any time. I gave you a situation yesterday where I outlined to you that it was very profitable that we ought to get involved in the Psalms. I give you this statistic. They say that figures don't lie, it's only liars use figures. I trust that you will accept these figures because they come from a reliable source. In the Old Testament, there are 283 quotes that are repeated in the New Testament. The New Testament contains 283 Old Testament quotes, straight out of the Old Testament into the New Testament. I can always remember a man saying to me when I talked about the New and the Old Testament, the New is in the Old contained and the Old is by the New explained. And I can always remember that at the same time as he told me that a text taken out of its context becomes a pretext. Some of these fellows have some quaint sayings, don't they? 283 quotes appear in the New Testament. Do you realise that of that 283, 116 of them come out of the Psalms? Approximately 40-odd percent of all Old Testament quotes appearing in the New Testament come out of the Psalms. The next major book is the book of Isaiah, and that's followed by Deuteronomy, and the rest share it about. So you can see that the New Testament, anybody who wants to study the New Testament and understand the New Testament church needs a definite working knowledge of the Psalms and of Isaiah. This is one of the reasons why Gideons hand out the New Testament with Psalms. I wonder if you've ever asked yourself why on earth do they hand out the New Testament and Psalms? Well, that's the reason why they hand out the New Testament and Psalms. Because it's the New Testament Bible and the hymn book. We ought to go with it. Think about it, will you? And you'll wonder why we sing something different. I wanted to, today, spend the time that I've got at my disposal looking at Psalm 2 and Psalm 1. I believe that Psalm 2 and Psalm 1 can readily be reversed. And in fact, I have heard a number of scholars and teachers explain the fact that Psalm 2 ought to be before Psalm 1. That the two Psalms should be reversed. Now, I won't go as far as to say that. But I will go as far as to say that there is a definite understanding and follow on that can be related with Psalm 1 following Psalm 2. And for today's exercise, I want to start with Psalm 2 and not Psalm 1, even though we're looking at two Messianic Psalms, the preface Psalm and Psalm 2. Now firstly, let's just read a little bit together after we note the fact that the Psalm is the Messiah, the Prince. This is Psalm 2, which is presenting the Messiah, the Prince, and all the problems that are associated with it. It sets forth the wonderful vision of the tumult of the people at that time against the Lord's anointed. And that's the first point. It's the tumult of the people. And you'll see some clear divisions, which I'll explain to you here. And they were against God's Son and the reign of His Son over their enemies. You'll note that as you read through this psalm, and watch it as we read it, will you, that it climbs gradually from the heathen who raged to the heavenly attitude of the blessed who put their trust in God. Now, I want you to understand that it starts from the heathen and it finishes in the heavenlies. And it's a wonderful escalation right through the second psalm. So first and foremostly, let's start to read. And I want to read it in a few bits. Verses 1 to 3 first. It's always good to start from 1. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? Question. The kings of earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. Here we find the total defiance of God. Here we find, as the opening verse in this magnificent book, a defiance against God. Why do the heathen rage? Why do the people imagine a vain thing? Here we see a situation where they are against the things of God. Now, secondly, note the fact that it's the heathen first. Why do the heathen rage? Then you'll go on to the people, then the kings, then the rulers together. And the psalmist is saying, all the people are against my God. And he's outlining it together, and he's starting right at the heathen, he's finishing in the kings, and he's saying, you're all in the same boat. You're all against God. And there he is pointing out how that we're defying the things of God and the total defiance of the things of God. Note how in verse 3, they break us, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. This is what the heathen are saying. This is what the ungodly are saying. This is the attitude of defiance that the psalmist is grabbing hold of. And he's saying here, look, they want to rid themselves of all their restraint. Let sin and Satan have the full reign in their world. And the psalmist is saying that all the heathen and the people and the kings, what they're doing, they're defying God. And they're saying within themselves, let's have no restraints. Let's not tie anything back. Hey, let me ask you this question. Where would you place the concept of doing your own thing in that relationship? Stop and think about it for a moment, would you? Here we find a situation, they're saying no restraints. Let them go. No standards. Open up the track. Make it an easy track. And the situation, they're defying the things of God. And they're saying no restraints. And that's what we're saying in the world today, aren't we? No restraints. No standards. No standards of dress. No standards of behaviour. No standards of conduct. No standards of conversation. No standards of literature. No standards of movies. No standards of education. Knock it all down. That's our problem. And it's exactly the same problem that the psalmist was confronted with. And here he is saying, you're defying God. You're breaking down the standards. You refuse to accept the standards. I tell you that the Christian life is a life that is built up to standards. The Christian life requires you and I to stand right on our tiptoes as far as standards are concerned. And it demands of us discipline, control, restraint. And the Christian life is one that's demanding of us something that's the highest, the very highest that we can reach in standards and beyond that. And God is claiming those standards for us. Oh, this is a tough one, isn't it? This is a tough one in an easy-going, free-flowing, let-it-roll type society, isn't it? That the Christian should have to stand up and say, look, when I go to the businessman's lunch, no alcohol. Not in that. And when the fellow wants to send that joke around the office, the Christian's the guy that's got to stand up and say, just excuse me before you say it, I'm leaving. That's not my kind of business. The Christian is the fellow that's got to stand up on the language issue. The Christian is the fellow that's got to stand up on so many points of standard if he's going to maintain a close relationship with his Lord and a strong testimony for Jesus Christ. And here were the people defying the things of God. Oh, there's a lot to be said about those first three verses. Go on to verse 4. He that sitteth in the heaven that laugh, the Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Oh, here we see something totally different. Here we see the derision. Here we see the derision that's so evident. Despite the defiance of men, God sits in relative silence, awaiting the time when he will intervene in his wrath. I sometimes wonder, when I see the situation of the world today and I look at the people today, how that God can possibly hold back. How on earth can God restrain himself? How can he possibly let the day of grace just continue that a little bit further? I don't know. It's beyond me. I think that you and I ought to be grabbing every available moment that we've got to use for God. I believe that we've got enormous responsibility. that we should be prepared to explain and to share and to preach and to tell and to teach and to show Christ. Oh, let's not get ourselves all caught up in this argument about this and that. Let's present Christ. Let's get right to the crunch matter of what we're really talking about. How many times do you see the office argument degenerate into a situation of the matter of creation or evolution and all this sort of business? Whether you go to church or not, what church do you belong to? What's the fundamental belief about this or that? And we miss Christ, don't we? Time and time again. And God sits in silence watching us perform. And I think sometimes he must get a sad heart. Don't you? Oh yes. God sits there quietly. Mark the quiet dignity of the Omnipotent One. It's a strong man who can stand and have mud thrown at him and say, "Nout." It's a strong God who can stand and allow his name to be buried in a filthy, blasphemous type world and stand by and let it happen. Oh, God in his omnipotence is clearly displayed here in this wonderful section of the Psalms. I want you to observe the perfect Hebrew tense. Have a look at those verses. I have set. Not I will set. I have set, God says. There is no doubt about the whole situation. It is completed in God's sight. I've done it. It's there. Finished. Set out and organised. Oh yes, I have set. Then we get into verse 7 to 9 and we see this marvellous decree. I will declare the decree. The Lord hath said unto me, Thou art my Son. This day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Here is the marvellous decree that God is sounding out in this beautiful psalm. We've looked into the council, the chamber of the wicked, to the throne of God, and now we see the anointed declaring his rights of sovereignty. Here is God declaring his very rights of sovereignty and a warning to the traitors of their doom. Compare that, if you will, please, with Romans 1:4, and you'll see a marvellous comparison. But we haven't got the time to shoot off into Romans for the moment. Note those words, ask of me. Two classic illustrations, one in the Old and one in the New, that I'd like to draw to your attention. Read again, will you please, the situation of Esther. Esther chapter 5, verse 6, where she came and she was invited by the king to ask. And Esther asked what she would of the king. Oh yes, a wonderful illustration. And then have another look in Matthew chapter 14 and verse 7. And you'll see another perfect illustration of asking of God. So ask of me is wonderfully illustrated. There's a wonderful lesson to be learnt in the complete destruction of verse 9. You'll see there where it says, Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces. Like what? Like a potter's vessel? Why? A potter's vessel. And God is saying concerning his son and those that are against him, I will break them like a potter's vessel. And that's the only vessel that you can't repair. You can't weld it, you can't cement it, you can't fix it. Once a pot is broken, it is broken. And God says it's a complete issue, I'm going to smash them down like potter's clay. And you can't use it again, can you? And you can't remake the pot. Once it's broken, it's broken. And God says that's what will happen. Then the final section, be wise now therefore, O ye kings, be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, let he be angry. And ye perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. Oh yes, we've seen the defiance, we've seen the derision, we've seen the decree, and finally we see the dependence, totally upon God. Oh yes, The psalmist concludes on the note of the blessed in a position of homage and worship. Homage and worship, that's the position. Engulfed in the blessednesses of God. And then we conclude that chapter, that psalm, with that great word, and therefore, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. Back into Psalm 1. Here we've seen the total decline of the situation into Psalm 2, and now we're coming back into Psalm 1 on the basis of what's happened in Psalm 2. We've had it open to us, and now here we come into Psalm 1 and we charge headlong into it, and it says, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. And the psalmist gives it to us straight in the eye, as it were. A clear introduction into Psalm 1. Psalm 1 is split in two halves. You've got from 1 to 3 and from 4 to 6. Six tremendous verses. The first three set out the source and type of blessings in store for the godly man, and the second three set out the state and the condition and the future of the ungodly man. Undoubtedly, it would appear as though that it was David that wrote it, and you can glean that quite clearly from Psalm 2. It was probably David, even though it's not told to you. And here we see in verse 1 the change in the Christian. Blessed is the man. And if you look up that in the original, you will find it says, oh, the blessednesses. It's in the plural. Blessed is the man. It's, oh, the blessednesses. There's heaps and heaps of them. No restrictions. Blessed is the man. It's a plural meaning of blessednesses, and it introduces a multiplicity in blessings in store for the man of God. And Psalm 1 kicks us right off that. But then, you'll note, too, that as you start to think about that, isn't that the same as Matthew 5, verse 3? Isn't that the same as the introduction to the Sermon on the Mount? Isn't it the same? Aren't we talking the same kind of languages? I assure you we are. And here we're seeing the Lord himself take up Psalm 1 and introduce the Sermon on the Mount in exactly the same way as Psalm 1. Beautiful comparison there if you wish to run the Psalms through the Sermon on the Mount. Marvellous. I want you to think for a moment, if you please, about the three stages of the man who's in verse 3, or the woman, or the girl. In verse 1, I meant to say, sorry. The three stages. And there's three clear steps. Firstly, there's the man who walks. Then there's the man who stands. And then there's the man who sits. You have a beautiful comparison here in reverse in the book of Ephesians. I don't know whether it's in the bookstore, but there is a good book, only a tiny little book, written by a man called Watchman Nee. Subsequently, Watchman Nee's literature has drawn a lot of adverse comments. But nevertheless, his early publication, and this one on Ephesians, it is called Sit, Walk, Stand. It's not a bad little publication. And it runs in reverse, through Ephesians, exactly what Psalm 1 introduces in the reverse. And in Psalm 1, you'll see the situation where it's walk, stand, sit. And Watchman Nee is bringing you up Sit, Walk, Stand. And that's the name of his book, Sit, Walk, Stand. Walk, Sit, Stand, or something like that. It's just the three words. But here you see this situation here. Here we have the man, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. What do you mean by counsel? Look up the word. What it means is after the manner, the principles and the plans of the ungodly. Blessed is the man who doesn't walk after the principles and the plans of the ungodly. And the psalmist is saying, here's the first step. Don't walk after their principles. Don't walk after their plans. Don't follow after those people. They're going to lead you astray. How many times do we see a situation where someone will say to us, particularly as we're young, don't go that way. Why? Looks all right to me. But that's the wrong way. How do you know? And we want to bring in a whole host of challenges to that sort of thing, don't we? We don't want to accept that sort of thing. And we don't get much better as we get older. Because we see things in our own lives where we say we shouldn't really be there, but it doesn't look too bad, so I'll compromise, don't we? Oh, I can see some people that are agreeing with this line of thinking. And I can assure you that that is so true, isn't it? And here we find the psalmist is saying, blessed is the man who walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. And then he's saying, nor standeth in the way of the sinners. Now here in the first instance we had this occasional conformity. This just walks not in the counsel. He just heard a bit of advice from somebody and he accepted it and he used it and dropped it and it didn't work too well and it didn't bring honour to his Lord and didn't encourage his testimony and didn't promote his Christian experience in any way, shape or form, and he dropped it and gone on. It was an occasional conformity. But now we see the man who stands, nor stands in the way of the sinners. This stand relationship, this is not just an occasional buy, bump, bump and away we go. This is a situation of stand in this situation, to get to a point where we actually stand with them. And so what's the psalmist saying here? He's saying it's a fixed association. How many times do we see people getting yoked up together? In Christian life and a non-Christian, getting tied together in partnerships. And I'm talking about partnerships in business. I'm talking about partnerships in sport. I'm talking about partnerships in marriage. I'm talking about partnerships of all sorts. And they're all open to us, aren't they? And we're so easily sucked in by the sweet-talking non-Christian who will get us involved in a partnership relation situation where we will have a fixed association. Oh, my friends, but look at the third one. Nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. Here we find a situation where we've taken up an established residence. We've not just walked along or bumped him and stood and talked, but here we have a situation where we've moved in and we've come completely entwined and teach and tempt others with this doctrine. And that's the situation. And the psalmist is saying, this is how you get hooked. First, it's just an occasional relationship. It might only just be on a business relationship. It's just occasional relationship. Then it goes a little bit further. And it's not long before you're totally entwined to this and you've got obligations in this way further now. And so you see where you've got obligations and commitments and responsibilities, and so you go along with it all. Oh yes, and then there's the verse 2. Here we see the challenge. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. Oh my friends, there's the challenge. The challenge to the Christian. You'll note that this verse has changed from the negative to the positive, would you please? In the first part we had the negative. Don't do this and don't do that. But now we've hit the positive. Now we've got a positive command. Let me ask you this question. What's your delight and pleasure? Where is it most? The psalmist is suggesting to you, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law doth he meditate day and night. Now I'm not suggesting that you've got to walk around with a Bible propped up in front of you everywhere you go. Nor am I suggesting that you've got to do that when you drive the car or anything else like that. And I do thank God that Ron Pierce doesn't do it, because I'm certain that he can't afford to. But I do suggest this. That the man and woman of God who is committed to the things of God has got to meditate on the things of God all the time. We need that thing going through our mind all the time, don't we? Because that's what keeps us in fellowship with God. That relationship, it's got to be open pipelines all the time. And it doesn't matter whether we're working in our office or whether we're working out in the field or whether we're working doing something else or whatever we're doing, the situation has got to be an open pipeline relationship with God. An attitude of prayer, an attitude of listening, an attitude of asking, an attitude of being in God's hands, directed and controlled by Him. And this is what the psalmist is bringing to us, this challenge to the Christian. And I bring it to you as a challenge from out of this tremendous book. Oh, there's a lot more to be said about this, and time's going to beat us, isn't it? Then we get into verse 3. Verse 3 could be spoken about for an hour on itself. It is a verse which is just absolutely packed with information. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. That verse to me represents an enormous amount. But we're going to handle it in just a few moments. Here we see a tree planted. Now I want you to note this. Now we're talking about this Christian man. And here we see the epitome of complete stability. A tree planted. Now you'll note that it wasn't a tree that just sprung up. It wasn't a tree that just grew wild. It wasn't a tree that just happened. You are a tree that God has planted in a particular place for a particular reason, to do a particular job, to bear a particular fruit. You're a tree planted. You didn't just happen. God has planted you. And if you have a look in any vineyard, in any orchard, you will see that the trees are planted in line. And no matter which way you look at them, when you drive past in a car, it's a line there and a line there and a line there and a line there. And no matter which way you look, you seem to be looking down a line, don't you? And that's an orchard. And God has planted us in a line. And God has expected of us to bring forth fruit. And God has put us in a particular spot. Note this, that it is a tree. It is a living, growing thing. Now I recognise with trees that trees change. A tree changes, doesn't it? And when you plant that tree in its position, you don't leave it exposed to the red hot sun and the wind and everything else, but you look after it. And some of us have got responsibilities to look after young trees planted in the orchard. And we've got responsibilities and commitments to those young trees, as well as to plant other trees in the orchard, but we've got commitments to those young trees, those ones. What does the Bible say about you and I? You know what the Bible says? Get hold of these words, will you? The Bible says to us, concerning causing one of these little ones to go astray, that it would be better if a millstone were tied around our neck and we were dropped in the drink. Stop and think about that, will you? It should really tear our heart out as to be how careful we ought to be with how we handle these little trees. They're God's trees and he's put them there and he's saying to you fellows, look after them, will you? Gently, Bentley, easy. They're little trees. Oh, and they're living. And note that they're going to change, and they're going to grow, and they're going to get a bit taller, and some of them are going to go way up, and some of them are going to outgrow you and me and all the rest of us, and praise God for that. They're going to develop into big Christian giants. And you and I have got the esteemed privilege of being able to put a little bit of water on them just when they're little trees, and stand back and watch them go. Oh, but there are some of us that want to put our hand on them, wouldn't we? We'd like to put our hand on them and just keep them right down there. It's not the trick, you know. It doesn't work. You've got to stand back and you've got to let them go and you've got to watch them grow and you've got to give them an encouragement. And some of us have got some responsibilities about those trees. Oh, yeah, some of them have got some responsibilities. When you look into John 15 in verse 2, you'll see that the vine got pruned, bits clipped off it. And I'll never forget a brother coming to me when I took a song service in shirt sleeves the first time and never wore my coat. And he clipped a little bit off. And oh, I hated him for it. I hated him for it, you know. I wasn't very gracious about it at all. But you know he was right. I learnt later that he was right. What that man was trying to do, he was trying to say to me, young fellow, when you get up on that platform, I want you to realise that you have a responsibility, that you have a commitment, that you have an obligation. You're not just there for the good of your physical health to wave your arms about in time with the muso down here. You've got a responsibility. Now get up and shoulder it. I don't want you to knock off, but I want you to realise you've got a little bit more than what you're looking at. And what he was trying to do, he was just gently taking the shears. I thought he was taking a jolly broad axe. But nevertheless, he was gently taking a little pair of shears and he was just clipping a little bit of the rough spots off. And I know that when we're a bit younger, oh boy, I can remember going along to the prayer meeting. And there was one fellow that used to go along to the prayer meeting. I married his daughter. And he was a quiet, meek man. I never heard him raise his voice. And I have to say to this day that he is the nicest man I ever knew. And that's saying something, isn't it? But that man, time and time again, when I would say things that would be wrong, when I would say things which were a wrong interpretation of the scriptures, he would just quietly say a word to me. Nothing out loud, just quietly, a little bit. And he'd straighten me up just a little bit. Oh yes, I can remember some of these men dealing kindly with this young whippersnapper Stapleton, who was a tree just planted in the vineyard. Oh yes, how are we handling our young trees? How are we handling them? Oh, it's hard to prune a bit off them, I know. But just be careful that you don't prune the core out of the front of the tree, will you? Don't prune the middle right out of the tree. Because you're not pruning the tree, you're going to stunt it. You're going to kill it. You're going to stop it. Just prune the bit off the side. It might look trivial. It might look insignificant. But you've got a responsibility to do it, and to do it in love, and to do it with prayer. Oh yes, the pruning of the tree. How important. You'll note that it's a tree that's planted by the river. Its water supply is not coming from you, the water supply is coming from the river, from God. It's planted by the river. It's in the favourite situation. It's going to bring forth fruit. It's going to bring forth Galatians 5 fruit, isn't it? It's that kind of a fruit. And when you see the tree that doesn't bring forth the fruit, the Bible says that by their fruit you shall know them, and you can tell the difference between apples and oranges and bananas by having a look at the fruit. It's very easy. I know some people would say, oh, but we're not to judge. I'll tell you what you are if you say that. I tell you, you're shirking your responsibilities. You don't like taking the pruning out. Or isn't this true? We say to ourselves, oh well, you know, John's going along pretty well, I think. And we like to ease back a bit, gently and softly. I can recall my father pruning some of our fruit trees, and he pruned them with a jolly bushman saw. He gave them heaps, and they bear good fruit for it. And sometimes, you know, when we get into the pruning business, we've got to cut off some big things. And sometimes we've got to have some big things cut off ourselves. Because we need that pruning. Note, will you please, that it is a... Note the situation of the leaves. His leaf also shall not wither. Note that this is an evergreen tree. He's a Mr. Go on and go on and go on. He's an evergreen tree. I can recall some of the people that I have met who I would say have got an unwithered testimony. My old friend Mr. George Houston, who lives in Springwood, a Scotsman who's almost a twin with my father. And that is a man that's had a career in Christian experience which I would say has been unwithered. He's always the same. He goes on and on and on. He's never varied. He's always the same. He's got that same look. He's got that same friendly attitude. He's got that same... He's an evergreen. And I can remember when I used to travel down on the train from the Blue Mountains, and he used to be there. And I used to go up and I used to ask him some things that I used to get stuck with from the Bible from time to time. And I used to go up there, and every day Mr. Houston would be sitting there, and he used to read his Old Testament and his New Testament, and it always used to stagger me that he didn't have any translation, he read from the original. And when a guy reads from the original, he's a bit hard to toss on translations, isn't he? But that's what Mr. Hurston used to do, and he used to sit there and he used to read quietly along. And this young fellow used to come up and ask him questions. And he used to gently answer my questions, and away I used to go. He used to sit up in the first class. I used to sit down in the second class. Of course, there was no third. But this was the situation, and I used to go and ask Mr. Hurston my problems. And he was an evergreen. His leaves were always there. And I can tell you a lot about the leaves that he supplied for shade and for protection for some of us young fellows in that assembly. And what's the promise? Look at the prosperousness that's promised. The final result of a happy man in God's will. Whatsoever he doeth, it shall prosper. Oh, there's the assurances all right, aren't they? They're there for us. But have a look at verses 4 to 6, and with these I'll close. This is the position of the ungodly. Here is the person who doesn't trust God, who hasn't got any faith in God, who's turned back from God, who's missed out on the things of God. And what's the Bible say? First point, the ungodly are not so, but they're like the chaff which the wind drives away. The chaff. No use for anything. We've knocked the wheat germ out of it, and here we have the empty husk and chaff, and the wind blows it away. Let me ask you this. How sure are you of your position before God? Where do you stand in your relationship with Jesus Christ personally? Maybe you've got some chaff in your life that you'd like to get rid of. Maybe you've got some ungodliness that you'd like to get out. Well, there's the chaff. Fruitless, empty, barren, useless, dead, dry. Of no use to God or to your fellow men. No doubt it's blown away, will you? Just blown away, destroyed and lost, got rid of, totally away. Look at verse 5. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment. Have you ever stopped and thought, where the ungodly are going to stand? Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment. They'll not stand in the judgment, but I thought the ungodly were going to be judged. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment. Shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. What does that mean? Stop and think about it, will you? In this world, you've got a situation where you've got the godly and the ungodly all mixed up together. And some of us sitting in this room, I feel quite confident, are not going to heaven. Now, let's be quite honest and frank about it. Some of us here are probably not going to go to heaven. Some of us are probably living a sham. Some of us are probably not being honest. Some of us are just going on and going through the motions. Look, these are very biting words. But I tell you, you can fool me. I wouldn't know. The person sitting alongside you wouldn't know. You can act out a total life of sham, big act. But you can't fool God. You can't fool God. And there's no fooling with God. And the ungodly will not stand in that day where the godly are handed out their rewards and judged. That's what that verse relates to. The ungodly shall not stand where the godly shall be, and the ungodly will not stand where the godly are handed their rewards and judged. And I ask us, will there be any stars in our crown? And when at evening the sun goes down, how do we rate in the sight of God? God leaves no doubt about Psalm 1. Verse 6 puts the total seal of the judge. For the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. There's the seal of the judge. Crunch. He doesn't only say that the ungodly shall perish. He says the very way of the ungodly shall perish. Its very way shall be wiped out. Total destruction. That's what God's talking about, oh my friends. Do you think these psalms have got a message for you and me? I reckon they're loaded stuff. I think they're absolutely packed with instruction and information for us today.
Feel free to read on.
I commend that Psalm 1 for you to commit to memory. Go away from this camp saying, well look, I learnt Psalm 1 at that camp. Why not, in the next few days, try and memorise Psalm 1? If you already know that, pick another one. You've got a few to pick from. Pick another one. But go away from this camp saying, I learnt a psalm. And if you go away from this camp saying, I learnt a psalm, you will have achieved, as far as I'm concerned, a very, very good blessing from God himself. To commit his word to memory is a tremendous thing. You've got a few days, you've got all afternoon, in between sleeps, you know, you can learn a little psalm.